I was reminded this past week of Malcolm Gladwell's retelling of a Princeton study in his book, The Tipping Point. You may remember the study as it involves the very parable we just heard. Several years ago, a couple of researchers wanted to see how this parabolic scenario might play out now in these United States. So they set up an experiment on campus and had someone who looked and sounded to be in great distress, slumped against a wall, groaning in pain. And then they devised a scenario in which people would encounter this man in need. To control their study, they used only Princeton seminarians. One would assume they would be uniformly upstanding, right? Well, regardless, the question was, would the seminarians stop? Would they check on the welfare of this man in need? First, though, for this experiment, they asked these divinity students why they had come to study for ordained ministry. Was it for spiritual fulfillment or for everyday practical application? Then, regardless of their answer, each of the seminarians was asked to prepare an extemporaneous address on a scriptural topic, which they would be delivering later in another building. Now, some of them presented on the role of professional clergy. Others on this very text, right? The parable known as the Good Samaritan. Then as a last instruction, some of the students were told, oh, you're late. They were expecting you a few minutes ago. We better get moving. The other group of students were told, it will be a few minutes before they're ready for you, but you might as well head over now. Okay, now it's the time for a show of hands. Who expects those who came to seminary seeking spiritual fulfillment, who expects those seminarians to stop and help this man in distress? Show of hands. Anybody? Okay, we've got some. What about those who came to seminary trying to find everyday practical applications for their faith? All right. Several more. Now, what about the biblical topics that they had just prepared? Who was more likely to see this man and assist? The group who presented on the role of the professional clergy? Anybody? Hands? A few? Thank you. And what about the group who was going to present on the parable known as the Good Samaritan? Right. Okay. Now, if you've read Gladwell's book, you know that those were actually trick questions. Because in the end, neither of those two variables made the biggest difference in the response of the seminarians. Not even when contemplating this iconic parable, right? In fact, the researchers concluded, indeed, on several occasions, a seminary student going to give his talk on the parable of the Good Samaritan literally stepped over the victim as he hurried on his way. Okay? So what's the biggest difference? It was whether or not they had been told that they were in a rush. Okay? For those who had been told that they needed to hurry, the rate of stopping to assist was 10%. Right? That includes those who were prepared to talk about that very text. And the percentage of the group that had been told that they had some time, regardless of their topic or why they came to seminary, was 63%. Right? Of those who believed they had the time, 63% stopped to check on the injured man. One of the greatest dangers of the parables, I think this is true of our sacred text as a whole, but particularly of our parables, one of the greatest dangers is actually having heard them before. Because often when we've seen the film, or we've read the book, or we've heard the story, we feel as if we know it, right? And so then we stop seeing it or hearing it. We stop encountering it in an open and frank way. This belief is underscored in our godly play classrooms. When we tell a parable, we begin by attempting to get ready. Because if we aren't ready for a parable, we are told, we can walk right past it. Or maybe even break it as we attempt to force it open. Now, I say this especially today as we encounter what is commonly known as the parable of the Good Samaritan. Because even if you haven't heard this story before you came here this morning, chances are you've come across some reference to it, whether in a law or in a Seinfeld finale. Due to its ubiquitous nature, each of us has likely brought our own frame to this powerful and hopefully upsetting story. And if we aren't careful, we might end up just walking right past it, blind to what is happening alongside. And so much like knowing who is in a rush and who has all the time they need, it is critical in any parable to know the context in which it's located. In Luke's gospel, and this parable is only found in Luke's gospel, it follows a number of encounters in which Jesus sees people that others don't. The widow of Nain, for instance, who is walking to bury her only son, and the man who is called Legion on account of his being possessed by many, and the woman who had been suffering from hemorrhages for many years. In each case, what is remarkable is that Jesus sees them. At this point, the 70 who had been sent out have returned with joy. And what does Jesus do? He blesses them for what they have seen. And then a lawyer, one who knows the law backwards and forwards. Now, this is the Torah, not the civil code. This lawyer comes to test Jesus, asking, "What must I do to inherit eternal life?" Now, like any skilled teacher, what does Jesus do? He asks the lawyer to first provide his own answer, right? What do you think? What do you read? Well, even 2,000 years removed, something tells me that this is what the lawyer had been wanting to do, to give his own answer, even as he tried to test Jesus. The lawyer's answer combines both Deuteronomy and Leviticus. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your mind, with all your soul, with all your strength, and your neighbor as yourself. Right answer, says Jesus. Do this and you'll live. Notice he did not say, do this and you'll have eternal life. Simply, do this and you will live. But this was not enough for the lawyer. Is it ever enough? And here I'm not just talking about the lawyer, I'm actually talking about us. Because the next phrase in our text is this, but wanting to justify himself, he asked Jesus. How often do we do this? Attempt to justify ourselves in order to convince those around us, but really often it's ourselves, that we are living in the right way. Right? We often doth protest too much. I've lived in and around the city or the Republic of Berkeley long enough to recognize this in myself. And so this is where I stumble as I enter this parable. Why the need to justify? If this lawyer, if we know the way to live, really to have life and to have it abundantly, then why the need to justify? The answer, it seems, comes in his question, and who is my neighbor? Who is my neighbor? Maybe this lawyer really did want to know. Maybe he was unsure. Or maybe he was looking for a loophole, maybe some wiggle room in the language. Or maybe he had a sense that this whole loving neighbor thing is much more challenging than it first appears. Maybe he is asking the question that all of us ask at one time or another. I might be alone in this when I look at someone and I say, them? Really? Well, typical to Jesus' teaching style, rather than answering the question directly, he tells a story. Now, a few notes are important for our context in this parable. One is the road. The road from Jerusalem to Jericho, which as of this day is now a road no more. It has been completely blocked by the wall that the state of Israel has constructed. This road was always known as a dangerous road. That this man would be beaten and robbed and left for dead would not have been surprising to first century listeners, as this road winds through, or did wind through, wilderness and offered thieves and robbers many secluded areas to ambush travelers. And then a few notes about our characters. The priest and the Levite seem to present themselves in this story to heighten our awareness of what is taking place. Because in the context of this parable, they stand in for this beaten man's people. There can be no doubt that they are this man's neighbor. And not just his people, but leaders of his people. Ones that we can expect would assist. Now, at different times, some have debated that because this man was at least bloodily injured and possibly dead, that the priest and the Levite could not stop out of concern for ritual defilement. I don't really believe that to be an issue because, you know, it's also a mitzvah to care for an unknown dead body. Now, they are part of this story to underscore a few things. One, that this was dangerous. Two, that they are without doubt this man's neighbors. And three, that when they saw him, what did they do? They passed on the other side. Now for the Samaritan. It is difficult for us to grasp how much this word, Samaritan, is intended to startle or to rattle us as the hearer. Because Samaritans were the enemy. Generations before, most of the Jews in Samaria had been driven out, they'd been exiled, and the remaining Jews had taken members of other races and cultures as husbands and wives, worshiped the one true God on another mountain, and were thereby seen as impure, as traitors, as half-breeds. So to hear the word Samaritan is to hear the word enemy. All right, let's put that into closer context. Right, who is this for us today? Right, is there a group that you might first die, then accept help from them? Right, is it the Klan? Right, the Tea Party? People from WikiLeaks? Is it George Zimmerman? Is it black bloc anarchists? Is it members of Al-Qaeda? Friends, it's pretty critical that we absorb this, as challenging as it might be, because all too often in our rush to see the remarkable kindness that takes place in this parable, we miss the scandal of just who is doing it. To be clear, I'm actually pro-kindness, right? Every time we say our prayers at dinner, we ask our children what kind action, right? What mitzvah they undertook that day. And Jesus, he's also pro-kindness. It's just that if this was going to be a parable about kindness, Jesus would have told it differently. For if this was simply about showing kindness to someone in need, there needs to be no details about a priest or a Levite or a Samaritan. It could simply be an injured man is assisted by a faithful Jew. Or if this was simply going to be a parable about loving our enemies, then you'd have the priest and the Levite, they'd represent the house of Israel, and then you'd have the Samaritan in the ditch, right? And then it would be a Jew who would be showing extraordinary love to this hated enemy. But that's not what we have in this parable either. Because in this parable, it is a Samaritan, a hated Samaritan who is moved. And again here, we've got my favorite Greek word, splachnizomai, right? That visceral, gut-wrenching feeling of compassion for another. It's a hated enemy who is moved to offer radical mercy. So we're supposed to be asking this question, why? Why has it got to be him? Like the lawyer, we often want it to be maybe the priest who saves him. And if it can't be the priest, at least let it be the Levite, right? I mean, they're the ones who we trust. They're supposed to be our neighbors. Those are the ones that we might want to be in relationship with. Or like at Princeton Seminary, we want it to be the ones who apply their faith in the world, or at least have studied the parable of the Good Samaritan. That's the way it's supposed to work. Except that, in this crazy, upside-down reign of God, that's actually not how it works. For Jesus tells us a story in which God's mercy flows to the broken from the Samaritan, the enemy, the very last person that any of us would want to see. And so this, then, is the final twist to our tale. After the Samaritan is shown to be unbelievably compassionate and generous, the question that Jesus asks is this. Which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of robbers? He does not ask, now, who is your neighbor? The original question. But instead he asks, who was being a neighbor to this broken, beaten man? And the answer the lawyer is forced to admit is the one who showed mercy, right? And this is part of what shows us the scandal. Because notice, he couldn't even say the word Samaritan. But just the one who showed mercy. And so this is the shocking, scandalous truth about being a neighbor in God's reign, that the grace of God can be, will be, mediated through the supposedly undeserving, inasmuch as this grace might flow from you or from me. Try as we might, whether through our own personal indifference, or by local custom, or by legislative action, or by proposition, or by verdict of the jury and judge, Jesus refuses to allow us to set limits as to who should deliver or receive God's grace. Like it or not, and often we do not, in the reign of God, mercy always comes as surprise.